The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful day here at our Edstone campus in the heart of the Midlands, right here in the central part of the UK. Happy to be with you. Today we've got quite a few sound bites lined up for the show. We've also, we're going to be continuing our Bible study that we got into yesterday on really bringing honor and fame to God and his family name. That's coming up in the second segment. Well, in 1989, the world changed dramatically, and we talked about some of this history just last week, the Friday program, I guess it was, if you want to refer back to that. But I want to refer to it again, that 30-year anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down, because George Friedman over at Geopolitical Futures had an excellent piece just recently about these 4 months that led up to the wall coming down and how that did change the world. And he refers to a couple of other seminal events from the 20th century and says here, like 1918 or 1945, this four-month period marked the end of one era and the beginning of another. It's 30 years since the beginning of this transition, and its meaning is only now becoming visible. It's only now becoming visible. The meaning of what happened on November the 9th, 1989. He talks in this article about, again, those other two dates, the ends of an era in both cases. And all of it revolved around Germany. That was the end of World War I, World War II. And then what happened in 1989, that certainly revolved around Germany as well. Winston Churchill, this is in the introduction to his book on the world crisis. Martin Gilbert, I think, wrote a short little essay to introduce the book. But he concludes by quoting from Churchill, who said, "How strange it is that the past is so little understood and so quickly forgotten. How strange it is that we so quickly forget the past." It says, "We live in the most thoughtless of ages." That's Churchill writing in 1931, saying that we live in the most thoughtful of ages. Switching back to Friedman's article, it says, "With the Soviet Union collapse and the United States indifferent, Germany was the European power. So the question became how to control Germany." That was the question following the fall of the Berlin Wall. All right, the Soviet Union's now collapsed. The United States is indifferent. So what next? How are we going to control Germany? Really, that was the question following World War II as well, wasn't it? How are we going to control Germany? Friedman says here, "The European Union was not created for free trade. That existed already. It was created to solve the dangers of nationalism, particularly German nationalism." It says, "Without assaulting the cherished principles of national sovereignty," it says, "this worked nicely so long as the EU monitored peace and prosperity reigned, but it didn't last long." And he talks about some of the history from the 1990s. 100,000 Yugoslavs died in war. A series of wars all through the 90s, the Europeans had failed to control war once again. Well, what he doesn't get into there, and you can read about this in my father's booklet, Germany's conquest of the Balkans. In fact, all of that conflict in the mid to late 1990s, it was triggered by Germany. Germany started those wars. People forget this. Well, even at the time, it was obscured, because everybody just went along with Germany. Germany wanted to break up those Yugoslav states, and that led to some bloody wars, 100,000. died in those wars. We forget this history. Friedman says, he talks about the current iteration of the EU, saying it has Germany as its economic center. The Germans are accused of fixing the euro to benefit themselves, limiting European economic and sometimes political choices, and so on. The EU has been and increasingly is a German question. And so just like these other seminal events, 1918, 1945, it's the German question that the world is concerned with, that the world is worried about, or at least should be. Friedman says, in each of the two steps on the road today, the German question has in some way been central. It triggered two world wars. It was the potential battleground of the third, and it resides at the center of the EU. The problem is that Germany is unlike other European countries in its productivity and its resilience. It is also a country that is always insecure, if not in military matters, then in economic ones. Therefore, he concludes, I think we are not at the end of history. It's been 30 years since the first steps into this latest epoch, which means a new shift is possible, though it may hold off for a decade or two, Friedman says. But, and this is my point, Europe is far from stable. It's far from a stable structure. And that is always dangerous for the world. When Europe is unstable, when there's instability in Europe, that's dangerous for the world. That's dangerous for the world. He says it may hold off for another 10 or 20 years. I mean, he's putting a timetable on it. We would suggest it's a fair bit shorter than that before the world comes face to face with the German problem all over again. Consider what Mr. Armstrong said on one of his old radio programs. We've played this clip so many times before, clip 9.
And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
Its heart is in Germany. An unstable Europe, that makes for a dangerous world. Well, you look around the world and there's lots of dangers. In the United States and Britain, of course, we see widespread moral sickness, bitter division, the Atlantic. This is a publication that started back at the outset of the Civil War in the 1860s. The Atlantic came out with its December issue just this week. The cover is How to Stop a Civil War. How to Stop a Civil War. Could there be another civil war in the United States of America? You look at what's happening in Washington just today. Today is the beginning of the impeachment circus. The New York Post, its cover on the newspaper today, says guilty, now for the trial. They've already decided. The Democrats have already determined that this president is guilty. But now we'll go on with the show trial. We'll carry on with this circus, this charade. Guilty, now for the trial. There were quite a few articles in our stack of news, that which we compiled this morning, talking about how the Democrats, I made this point the other day, they've gotten away from quid pro quo, because, well, that's a Latin term that just sounds too nice, I guess you could say. It's not strong enough. So they're opting for bribery and extortion now. All of this over a phone call, a 30-minute phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. There's another piece in the stack that talks about the two witnesses that the Democrats are bringing forward today, William Taylor and George Kent. And one journalist says what Taylor and Kent heard would never be considered in a court of law. They're bringing forward these two witnesses because of what they heard from someone else. Hearsay. It says the fact that Schiff's leading with them, indicates he has no real evidence. These are his, I guess, this is the beginning, so you come forward with your star witnesses right off the bat, and he's just bringing forward two Democrat activists to say, well, I heard something bad about that phone call. It wouldn't even be admitted in court. Imagine a prosecutor in a murder trial leading with two witnesses who didn't know anything about the crime but heard a rumor the accused was guilty. Imagine that. This is from the New York Post. These are Schiff's leading witnesses, and it shows that he doesn't have any evidence. It shows there is no crime. But they've decided that he's guilty. The president's guilty. And so now we go forward with the trial. Jim Hansen at the Federalist, he offers this definition for deep state. Well, the title of his piece is Alex Vindman. There's another one of their so-called witnesses. It says, Vindman is living, breathing proof that the deep state exists, and it is corrupt. It is corrupt. He defines deep state this way, the permanent professional bureaucracy of the U.S. government, specifically those who believe their judgment and continual service makes them better suited to run the country than elected officials or political appointees. See, they see themselves as better suited to run the country than the person that the people vote in there, President Trump. They know more. They divine motives, as we've covered. They know when it's evil, they know when it's good. And they heard some things about this phone call. They heard that it was evil. This article says, that's accurate, but to expand on why it matters, we should note the political contributions of federal employees in the last presidential election went 95% to Hillary Clinton. So it's just like in the media. The contributions that they make to political campaigns, overwhelmingly, it goes to Democrats. The bureaucrats love the Democrats. The media love the Democrats. Hollywood loves the Democrats. It says here, there's nothing illegal or nefarious about that, these campaign contributions, that is, but it certainly points out the one-sided political nature of this cohort. You can see why President Trump's going up against so much. It's not exactly, I don't think it's exactly possible to drain this kind of a swamp. So many people deep in the deep state who hate this president and everything that he stands for. It says any mention of this is immediately discounted and attacked by the media because they have a symbiotic relationship with these folks, the bureaucrats, that is, the deep state. They're the sources for most of the leaks. It says they treat it as a conspiracy theory, and if you were to criticize this, that is, the media will respond by saying, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. It says, having come to the president and missed on Russia, that is, they decided to redouble their efforts. So we come to the impeachment inquiry, currently operating in full kangaroo court fashion. Here comes the kangaroo court. Speaking of Vindman, that's the one he focuses in on this particular article. He's the one who testified about the views of this president being inconsistent with the consensus views of the interagency. How dare this president take a view that's inconsistent with the interagency? In other words, the bureaucrats in the DOJ or the FBI, the bureaucrats in the intelligence community. He disagrees with this president's foreign policy on Ukraine. So they're gathering up all of these so-called whistleblowers, the Democrats are, in hopes that they can impeach this president. President Trump, by the way, he agreed to release the transcript of another phone call that he made to the Ukraine president. The first one, I guess, there was one before July 25th, and so he said that he's going to release that transcript sometime later this week. This probably will catch some of his enemies off guard, like it did the first time around. So we'll see what's said or what was said in that first phone call. But here's one commentator on Fox yesterday, Newt Gingrich, commenting on the releasing of that that transcript, the second transcript, clip one.
Well, I think the president's case is that he has consistently dealt with Ukraine much better than Obama did. He's helped them much more than Obama did. He has a natural ally in the new reform president of Ukraine. And in the president's mind, I think he believes that he was asking for help in getting to the truth, which is the opposite of what was going on with the Democrats and the Steele dossier and all the lies they were generating. So I suspect the president, at one level, is sort of frustrated with this idea that Hunter Biden can go off and make $3 or $4 million and nobody's supposed to be allowed to find out whether or not it was corrupt, and that Joe Biden can go off and threaten to take away $1 billion in aid to Ukraine and nobody's allowed to question whether or not it was corrupt. But any word that President Trump uses is somehow suspect. And I think he's trying to say, look, I'm being as open as I know how to be because there isn't anything substantive here.
He's as open as he knows how to be. You want the transcript? Here you go. Well, yes, I did ask about Biden. You should look into that. You should look into it and see if there is any corruption there. But he can't say that. He can't say that according to the Democrats. According to the media complex, it is a complex. It's all joined together. You can't even ask about it. Any language that he uses is somehow suspect, as you heard there. And by the way, who is the president of the United States in cahoots with here? Is it the president of Russia? Is it the leader of Russia or the leader of Ukraine? Because they're not exactly best friends right now. Russia just helped itself to Crimea a few years ago. This was during Obama's watch. First, he's an agent, a secret agent representing Vladimir Putin. Now it's Zelensky. Or I guess in the case of the phone call, he's obviously abusing his power, extortion, bribery, whatever it is. One last quote here from, or soundbite from, Newt Gingrich, clip two.
All of this is garbage. The idea that this president is saying to the Ukrainians, help me get to the truth. I mean, when did the New York Times and the Washington Post suddenly decide that covering up the truth is a good idea? This is crazy. And the Democrats, frankly, are behaving in a way that's crazy. Historians are going to look back and they're going to say this whole case was totally made up.
Totally made up. Just craziness. It's on display. When did the New York Times and the Post suddenly decide that covering up the truth is the way to go? He went on to say how that this is all just an orchestrated coup. It's like the Salem witch trial. And today it comes out into the open. Everyone gets to see the circus. Over at Newsbusters, there's a column there. As the Democrats gear up for their impeachment hearings and the networks all prepare to preempt their regular programming to help the Democrats ruin President Trump, there's one thing we know. The networks are always and forever going to try and beat this president senseless with negative coverage. You know how they're going to cover this. It is out of control. It says here the latest study by the Media Research Center's Rich Noyes finds that during the 6 weeks since Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced the start of the inquiry, the ABC, CBS, and NBC evening newscasts have shoveled out 398 minutes of coverage on the Ukraine scandal. Important, yes, but it's more than three-fifths of all administration news during this time period. This is three-fifths of the coverage of everything that this administration is doing. This one phone call this 30-minute phone call from July 25th. No wonder the president takes to Twitter to try to get his message out, to try to tell America about his agenda. Did any one of these big networks cover the president's speech yesterday, for example, the one he gave at the Economic Club of New York? Did that get any minutes on the three big networks or the cable news stations? Listen to what the president said just yesterday about the economy, clip three.
In 2016, the Department of Labor predicted that Americans would continue dropping out of the workforce in record numbers. They predicted and projected a decade of sluggish growth, and they expected unemployment over 5%, and really 6%, 7%, and even in some cases 8% for years to come. The so-called experts said the Americans had no choice but to accept stagnation, decay, and a shrinking middle class as the new normal. That was said all the time. In short, the American people were told to sit back and accept a slow, inevitable decline. But I never believed for one moment that our magnificent nation was destined for a diminished future.
That's President Trump yesterday at the Economic Club of New York. A nearly hour-long speech, packed with quite a lot of content about the economy and other things, content that you're not going to hear about on the news channels. Newsbusters, when talking about that being 3/5 of all the administration news, the Ukraine phone call, it went on to say, here's what's truly amazing. The tone of overall coverage was 96% negative. That makes the long-running average of 90% look good. It's no longer 90% negative. It's pushing its way toward 100%. The whole focus of phone call and all of the coverage, negative. And meanwhile, you have all of this positive, not all of it's positive with respect to the economy, certainly not the national debt, but there are a lot of positive developments these past 3 years and over and again. This is what the president pointed out yesterday. He talks about what he came into in 2016 and 17. He talks about the statistics or what they were saying, some economists or analysts, saying that, look, we've just got to get used to this slow, inevitable decline. That's what the Obama administration was saying. Just get used to it. Hey, we're going to lose the manufacturing jobs. We've got to learn new skills, I guess. Here again is what the president said just yesterday, clip four.
Back in 2016, before I took office, the Congressional Budget Office projected that fewer than 2 million jobs would be created by this time in 2019. Instead, my administration has created nearly 7 million jobs and going up rapidly. We beat predictions. Thank you. We beat predictions by more than 3 times the highest estimate that I saw during the campaign. Nobody thought it was even possible to get close to a 7 million number. 2 million was maxed out if you were lucky and if you did a great job.
2 million was maxed out. Nobody would have expected 7 million. This is all in less than 3 years. He's talking about a 2.5-year bracket here. Since he came into office in January of 2017, he went on to talk about the average median income for Americans. Clip five.
The average median income under President Bush rose only $400 over an 8-year period. Under President Obama, it rose $975 over an 8-year period. And under my administration, it rose $5,000 over slightly more than just 2.5 years. That's a big difference. And if you remember, President Obama was paying 0% interest for a long period of time, while we're paying a much higher rate of interest. But in addition to the $5,000, we have to add $2,200 for the tax cuts, average tax cuts, and $2,000 to $3,000 for regulatory and energy cuts. So that would be a total of almost $10,000 versus $400 and versus $975. So that's something.
That is something. 2.5 years. It's a pretty dramatic increase compared to not just the Obama administration, but the one before that as well. He talked further about the onslaught of regulations that he inherited. Clip 6.
Within days of taking office, I issued an executive order to end the outstanding, horrible federal intrusions that you saw. It was an onslaught into business, into people's lives, and it was really done by unelected bureaucrats. They were really accountable, and nobody held them accountable. And sometimes it's not pleasant to hold them accountable, but I do it. I do it. And we had no choice because we were going nowhere fast.
My father makes the point, remember, in the Saving America article, temporarily. That's from last year, early part of 2018. Just how that when you compare the two administrations, this one and the one before it, there certainly is a clear change in direction. The media, though, they have no interest in this. Not interested in it one bit. 3/5 of their coverage over the past 6 weeks, when it comes to this administration, 3/5, 60% of the coverage is the Ukraine phone call from July, 30-minute phone call. And meanwhile, the agenda for this president, it goes forward in many respects. Here's what he went on to say yesterday, clip 7.
A lot of these leaders don't like me too much, folks. When you hear that I'm not so popular in various countries, please don't accept that as, gee, he doesn't have a good personality. Just realize what I'm trying to do for you. It's about time, okay? Please. They recently came out with a poll that President Obama is much more popular in Germany than I am. I said, guess what? He should be. He should be. The day I'm more popular than him, you know I'm not doing my job. Let's put it that way.
That's President Trump yesterday. We're on the eve of his impeachment, his possible impeachment. And there he is saying, look, Obama's popular in Germany for a reason. And it's not surprising that he's more popular in Germany than me. The moment I'm more popular than him over there, then you know I'm not doing my job. It says something about this man's character to stand up to that Antiochus force, to that deep state, even when they're bringing forward all of their witnesses, their star witnesses, to talk about hearsay. And the media, they're hyped up thinking this is historic. They're telling young people, this is historic. This doesn't happen. Sometimes it doesn't even happen every generation. They're so excited to have an impeachment trial. And here is this president singling out his predecessor. My father said, Donald Trump has proved himself willing to take a stand where others have not. It's quite something to behold him resisting these anti-American forces. It's quite something, if I might add to that, it's quite something to behold him resisting these anti-American forces even the day before his impeachment or the beginning of the impeachment trial. Well, he went on to say in that Saving America piece my father did that this president's he's exposing a tremendous amount of lawbreaking. He certainly is. One final clip here. He talks about, and this, of course, is right in alignment with what my father wrote in that that Trumpet magazine in the early part of 2018. This is the president talking about the American resurgence. Clip 8.
Today, the world is witnessing the resurgence of a strong and proud and prosperous America. The world is a better place because of it also. But everything that we've achieved is under threat from the left-wing ideology that demands absolute conformity, relentless regulation, and a top-down control of the entire U.S. economy. Far-left politicians in our nation's capital want a massive government takeover of health care. They want to give government bureaucrats domination over every aspect of your business and your life. They want to eliminate American oil and natural gas. They want to enlist us in global projects designed to redistribute American wealth and kill American jobs all over our nation. Washington's Democrats and their radical agenda of socialism would demolish our economy, reinstate the avalanche of regulations that have already ended, decimate the middle class, and totally bankrupt our nation. As long as I'm president, America will never be a socialist country.
That's the president of the United States yesterday exposing the radical left for what it is, its ideology, how that it demands absolute conformity. He has been willing to take a stand, even on the day before the impeachment proceedings began. He said there at the start of that last clip, the world's witnessing the resurgence of a strong and proud and prosperous America. As my father noted in that article last year, referring back to that history with the first Jeroboam, God granted mercy when Israel really didn't deserve it. Rather than sending Israel into captivity at that time, God used this king to save Israel and to give them one more age of prosperity before Assyrian conquest. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
So God is going to bring suffering and evil upon all flesh, he says, until they repent. Until they repent. And he's saying to Baruch, look, Baruch, Get your mind off great things for yourself. Get your mind off pursuing great things for you and pursue great things for God. We have access to over 300 million people in this television program. And our publications reach out to hundreds of thousands of people. Great things of God. God says, get wrapped up in what I want you to do, and I'll give you all kinds of blessings, and I'll even protect you from the terrible times that are coming. That's exactly what he told Baruch. He said, look, I'll even protect you physically. I'll give you all kinds of blessings, but don't be out wrapped up in yourself seeking great things for yourself. Learn to seek great things for God.
That's a blast from the past there. My father's program back in 2004, 15 years ago, talking there about Baruch and that passage that we finished the program with yesterday, Jeremiah 45, and how that Baruch, Jeremiah's assistant, I should say, was seeking great things for himself. And so God corrected him and said, look, don't get wrapped up in yourself. Just seek great things for God, and then I'll take care of you. I'll bless you. I'll protect you. What does Matthew 6:33 say? Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and then all these things will be added unto you. You'll have everything else as well. If we just get the right spiritual orientation and focus, if we just get the right priorities, God's priorities, God's desires, and we make those our desires. I want to play part of a clip that I used yesterday. This is my father in a 2014 Key of David talking about King David. This was before he was king, actually. He slew this giant, this giant Philistine. And my father in this program is talking about why David did it. What motivated him? Clip 11.
What an earth-shaking example that is that David set for all of mankind. He wanted to show the whole world and everybody on this earth that there is a living God in Israel. And there is a living God that rules his church today. That little remnant that did not fail to honor their father, but honored him. But do you see, I mean, honestly, if you look at this the way David did, do you see how faith can motivate us to do amazing deeds and just accomplish awesome things if we really, really believe God? David just wanted the whole world to know about the living God, that there is a living God in Israel.
I love that last statement in particular. David just wanted the whole world to know about the living God. Is that your ambition every day? Do you wake up with that as your focus? To just want the whole world to know about the living God. Right at the outset of the prayer outline there in Matthew 6, it says to pray thy kingdom come. Well, you hallow God's name, but I mean the focus of that prayer is on God's royal name and his royal kingdom. And we want the whole world to have it. That's doing great things for God. In that same Key of David from 2014, my father made this point with respect to young people, because David, as you know about that battle with Goliath, he was just a teenager. Here's what my father went on to say in clip 12.
Well, David said in Psalm 71 and verse 5 that I trusted God from my youth. You young people, you teenagers, are you willing to trust God the way David did and do great things for God? You could. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever.
So many great examples in the Bible. God using young people. David, of course. Jeremiah. These were youths. Josiah became king when he was 8. Jesus, of course, died in his early 30s. Timothy, he joined on with Paul when he was 18 or 19. lots and lots of young people who wanted to do great things for God. I mentioned at the start of the study yesterday the example of Winston Churchill, in that when he was young, he wanted to do great things for his empire, the British Empire. And there's lots of lessons that we can take from that example if you just apply it to God's empire. Churchill was a man of courage, and so many of these heroes of the Bible, David, of course, again, comes to mind because of his willingness as a youth to face down giants. Now, that took some courage. And if we're going to do great things for God, we need to be courageous people, for sure. Courageous people. Winston Churchill at the age of 21, just barely out of his teen years, he surveyed the world of 1895 and thought, well, there's no conflict anywhere. He was disappointed because he wanted to get in on one of the hot spots. He even thought about how it might have been better to be born at the end of the previous century, during the Napoleonic Wars. Well, the only hot spot really on Earth in 1895 was in Cuba, but that didn't involve the British Empire. So he decided to go join the conflict as a war correspondent. And to do that, he petitioned the assistance of Britain's ambassador to Spain. He immediately tried to get some special favors from people that he knew or that his mother knew. And so he was there, right where the fighting was. And then when he returned to England, he learned that his cavalry regiment, the 4th Hussars, they were being stationed in India in 1896. And that's where, and I've brought this out before on programs, but that's where he really educated himself. He was a self-educated man. He read and studied while others were napping in the afternoon. He wanted to establish a name for himself. He was a man of ambition. But always, always, he wanted to get in on the action. And when there was a conflict that broke out, in this case, in the northwest of the frontier of India, he wanted to join the front lines. And here again, he made use of one of the contacts that he had made while in England for that short time, asking one of the commanding officers of those forces in India, look, if you ever get into a conflict, can I join the front lines? William Manchester says that when he learned that he was going to get in on the action in India, he was electrified. He wanted to get in on the action in Cuba, in India, in the Sudan. This was one of his most famous battles, the Battle of Omdurman, that famous charge of the 21st Lancers. That was in 1898. That was the last great cavalry charge of the British Empire. I've mentioned some of this history before on the program. But he was committed to action, even dangerous action. He had to be courageous. He had to be bold. My father wrote this in the Royal Vision. He said, Churchill had to endure a lot of difficulty when he went off to those wars, but the military experience helped build a lot of courage in him. That courage would eventually give him the gumption to stand up to Adolf Hitler and to be the man that Britain needed to win the war. They needed a man of courage to win the war. And we need to be men and women of courage if we're going to win our spiritual war. We're not going to go off into the army, travel to India or Cuba or wherever. But we certainly need spiritual courage. We certainly need to stand up for God when everyone else in this world just loves darkness. Manchester said about Churchill being in many ways a coward, particularly at school, there is no ambition. This is actually quoting Churchill. There is no ambition I cherish so keenly as to gain a reputation of personal courage. He really wanted to gain the reputation of being courageous. It says, apart from its political value, physical courage had an intrinsic value in his eyes, and the lack of it was shameful. He grew up at a time where it was a shame for a young British lad to be afraid or to be a coward. It was shameful to lack courage. Joshua, the book of Joshua, highlights just how important it would be for Moses' successor to be a courageous man. He was going to have to take the Israelites into the promised land, and he was going to be facing a lot of resistance. And so God said, be strong, Joshua. Be of good courage. Be brave, bold, stand firm. James in the New Testament talks about faith being mixed together with works. We have to act on this truth. God said to Joshua that you're going to cause the people of Israel to inherit the land. Joshua was the cause. He had to lead. He had to be a man of action. And that took courage. God said, be strong and very courageous. He emphasizes it over and again, right there in the first chapter of Joshua. And then again at the last chapter, chapter 23, be you therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. It takes courage to obey God. It takes courage to keep his commandments. Notice this quote from the Hebrews booklet. My father's new booklet on Hebrews. He says, so many people live rather scared and off in a corner. God says, that's not the way I live. That's not the way I want you to live. He has a plan and a formula to give you great confidence, faith, joy, and courage. That's a wonderful way to live, my father writes, when you don't fear anything or anyone but God. There's nothing like it. He says the great men of the Bible set a magnificent example in this regard. Paul repeatedly faced down life-threatening persecution, and he was so passionate for God that he considered it a bargain to be able to suffer. Knowing what a bright future he had, you think about some of the statements that Paul made at the end of his life. You know, this has been a good fight. There's a crown waiting for me. He fought for God. He was crucified with Christ, as it says in Galatians 2:20. Nevertheless, I live, Paul wrote, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. The point my father makes in the Hebrews booklet is just how personal Paul makes that. Jesus Christ loved me. He didn't say us. He could have. He could have said us because he loves us too. But Paul says he loved me. I know he loved me. He sacrificed all for me. And so God wants for me to be a living sacrifice for him and for others. Back to Joshua. Joshua 10 here in verse 25, it says, and Joshua said unto them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus shall the Eternal do to all your enemies against whom you fight. They were going to have to conquer all of the enemies upon taking the promised land. Half of the book of Joshua is about Joshua's conquests in Canaan. It took him 6 or 7 years. This was not an easy struggle. This was not a short-term struggle. This was a years-long battle, a series of battles. Everywhere that he went, he faced resistance. Everywhere the Israelites went, every square inch of Canaan, they faced resistance. Verse 23, it says, "So Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Eternal said to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land rested from war." Finally, after 6-7 years, Joshua causing the people to inherit the land, then finally the land, it says, rested from war. In Malachi's message, my father talks about Joshua's courage and how that may be our greatest need today in this Laodicean era. Certainly there are a lot of Laodicean Christians who are, spiritually speaking, cowering in fear. My father said, without courage, the other virtues are of little value. God's people can't cower in fear and still grow in God's love. It takes courage to grow in love. It takes courage to strive for perfect obedience. So many people live rather scared and off in a corner, as he said in the Hebrews book. But that's not the way God lives. That's not the way God thinks. What a strong statement, whether you look at that Hebrews book or the one I just gave you in Malachi's message. What a strong statement with respect to courage. That may be our greatest need today. Those of us in God's church, those of us supporting God's church, it takes courage to do great things for God. It takes courage to get out there and to honor God. It takes courage to follow God. I won't take the time to turn over there. John 21, verses 18 and 19. This is in the last chapter of the Gospel of John. Jesus talking to his disciples, telling them about the lambs and how to look after those that would come into the church. And he's telling his disciples, look, just make sure that you follow me and I'll lead you to where you need to go. Commenting on this passage, my father said this in a program back in 2010. This is from the Key of David. Do you love Christ? Clip 13.
How about that? Just, well, follow me. That's what you're supposed to do. If you follow God, it's going to take you in places where you would not have gone. That's what he's saying. If you want to glorify God, you're going to be taken places you would not have gone on your own. God, if you follow Christ and where he leads you.
That's my father again from 2010. If you follow God, if you follow Christ, we're going to be taken places that we would not have gone on our own. On our own, we don't slay giants. On our own, we're not in the middle of the arena with wild animals, as Paul was. On our own, we wouldn't jump into a lion's den or a fiery furnace. But if we follow God, God may lead us right into that furnace, but he'll be right there with us. If we're determined, bound and determined, to do great things for God, to bring honor and glory to God, then God will take us places we never would have gone on our own. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.